Hey everybody, Brian McClanahan here. The woke madness in history education is off the rails. Well, how do we change it? McClanahanacademy.com. And because you listen to this podcast, if you use the coupon code PODCAST at checkout, you get 25% off every day, all day, 365 days a year on every class at McClanahanacademy.com. So go to McClanahanacademy.com, use coupon code PODCAST at checkout, and get a real history education at 25% off. If you like this podcast and you want it without advertisements, head over to patreon.com and become a member of the Brian McClanahan Show. For $10 a month, you get all the podcasts ad-free, including video, and you also get a special Q&A podcast. I'm only going to answer your questions, your listener-generated episodes, through those Q&A. So, head over to patreon.com. Get this podcast ad-free, no ads, not even things like this, and you really do help support the Brian McClanahan Show with really cool stuff on the back end. If you follow me for some time, you know I write a lot about the South, and my book, Southern Scribblings, is a collection of many of those essays. It's a great book. You're really going to want it. It tells you why I think the Southern tradition should be preserved and why it should be respected. Get Southern Scribblings at Amazon.com, BarnesandNobles.com, wherever books are sold online. You're really going to love it. What does a post-liberal world look like? We'll talk about that on this episode of The Brian McClanahan Show.
It's time to think locally and act locally. Welcome to The Brian McClanahan Show.
Welcome back to The Brian McClanahan Show. Glad to be back on the program. Very glad to be here. Well, got a couple of really interesting articles in Chronicles Magazine for the latest issue. And the cover of Chronicles, it says, "Can American classical liberalism be saved?" That's an interesting question, because I think that at its core, it argues that America never really had a conservative history, right? It's the Lewis Hart's thesis that an American conservatism never existed, that it was always based on classical liberalism. Interesting premise. It's something that every conservative in America has to wrestle with. Now, I would disagree with that. I think there is an American conservatism or an American conservative tradition, maybe not an ism, not a set of, not an ideology, but an American conservative tradition that is not necessarily anchored to classical liberalism or John Locke. But the pieces, particularly one by Paul Gottfried, take a look at what happens if this classical liberal order goes away. In fact, I want to talk about that piece, because he makes, in the first part of it, the title of this essay is "Our Grim Post-Liberal Future." And he says, "Liberalism at its height, which was the 19th century Western world, fostered certain identifiable political and moral developments. There were, among other things, constitutional government, a well-defined distinction between the state and civil society, a generally free market economy, and a high regard for private property." Now, that's fine. I mean, the liberal world, quote-unquote, protected those things to an extent. And then he goes on to say, well, wait, the liberal world didn't mean all of these things, though, which I'm going to get into. So he says there was this structure that was there, and then you had people start to distort that. Who were these people? How were they working this? Now, one thing I find fascinating about that is that he's basically making the claim that these things are related to the liberal world. And look, I love Paul Gottfried. The one thing I would question with this, if that's simply related to the classical liberal world, I mean, you can look at the social contract theory, and you look at Locke or Rousseau or Hobbes or any of them. But Locke and Hobbes, as he says, are living in a particular time in a particular place based on particular circumstances. There is a historical component to all of this. But why were they looking at these things in the 17th century? And this gets back to something, say, maybe Patrick Henry would have said in the 18th century. Why were they doing it? Because they already had traditions in place that would make those things possible. Traditions that dated back, in the case of Hobbes or Locke, 400 years. And that would go back to the Magna Carta. Was the Magna Carta part of the classical liberal world? And branching this out, if you take, gosh, if you go to Leo Strauss, and you start to think about a Straussian position, you're either a Christian or you're an Aristotelian, you believe in the classics or you believe in a Christian moral order, there's something going on there. Christianity allowed for the warlords of Europe, the feudal lords, to have a metaphysical sanction to their dominance. But that was born out of something else. When the Germans weren't Christian, the Romans were still admiring them for their traditional views on society, and the Romans, not being Christian, still had the Soviet. But regardless, there still was a metaphysical component to all of that. Now, I want to go into this piece a little more. He says, what liberalism properly understood did not require or necessarily encourage are the following: female suffrage, redistribution of income, tolerance of bizarre sexual practices, replacement of nation states by international organizations, and the tolerance of clearly inflammatory speech intended to overthrow the government. So he's saying liberalism didn't necessarily mean these things. And this is true. Because in this is where you have to get to the American conservative variety. And he brings up constitutions. Constitutional government. What does that even mean? The American model was different than the European model. And I think we have to be careful. Now, Chronicles magazine is not just interested in the United States. It is a magazine of culture. And so you're looking at Western civilization, European culture, as well as American culture. But what the American constitutional order allowed to happen was a preservation of the traditions and customs of the local through the principle of a federation or federalism. It allowed for those things to exist. So, if you wanted to be a kook in Massachusetts, you could do it all day. But you shouldn't be able to affect South Carolina. Or vice versa. If you're in South Carolina, the people in Massachusetts think you're a kook too. You could be a kook in South Carolina and Massachusetts didn't have to tolerate that. They were in a union with you for economic and defensive purposes. But that's it. And as you break down the American states into the states themselves or regional areas, you can see that there are strenuous, fissures breaking there between these sections. I mean, they're cultural, they're legal, they're political, and the way that these people looked at society. So at its core, American conservatism is going to have a commitment to federalism, a commitment to a decentralized federal order that allows for the local to have a tremendous amount of control over its own polity, over its own political life. And in that political life, you would have some impact by the state. Now, he says that liberalism has a well-defined distinction between the state and civil society. This would be the written constitutions. Now, the question is, what about in some place like Rhode Island, which until the 1840s still maintained its colonial charter? There wasn't any written rules there. So you could say there's kind of an unwritten constitution. There's the custom and precedent that had been established, but this led to actually a rebellion against the Rhode Island government by the Dorrites, they were called, who said, we need a different constitution. Because what you're doing is violating, you're not having have access to property. I mean, we couldn't get any, so we can't vote. So that was a very conservative order. And if you want to say that, I mean, the freeholders in Rhode Island, which there are very few, were blocking just about everybody else from having access to the ballot. So this is a fascinating discussion. What is the American conservative order and what is conservatism overall. I mean, how does this work? But I would agree that all of these things, all of these reform movements, weren't required by classical liberalism. But as you start becoming, as you start viewing the world through the lens of a distorted version of equality, you're going to get these things. This is what's going to happen. Now, tolerance of clearly inflammatory speech intended to overthrow the government. Sedition is what he's talking about there. Yeah, the classical liberal world doesn't necessarily tolerate sedition. But what does overthrow the government actually mean? Is it language that would simply just try to replace the existing order with another one? Is that inflammatory speech? Is that overthrowing the government? Is essentially then a voting system overthrowing the government? These are questions that you would have. So when you go to 1798 in the United States and the Congress passes a Sedition Act, which was clearly unconstitutional, again, constitutional order, written constitutions in contrast to unwritten models, but regardless, another American conservative position. When you have that, people are saying, well, states can do this, but not the general government. So could the states be very structured in what they would do? He says, although liberals in Catholic countries typically clash with clerical authorities, very few were atheists. In Protestant countries, liberals were almost always churched. Both English Prime Minister William Gladstone and French Premier François Guizot, for example, were devout Protestant Christians. English historian Lord Acton was a fervent liberal but also a religious Catholic. Providing such contextualization for liberalism, or so goes the argument of my book, After Liberalism, is essential for distinguishing the real article from the vagaries and eccentricities of those systems and people claiming to be liberal in this post-liberal age. He says, for instance, it's all fine and good if a homosexual atheist abandons some aspects of the LGBTQ cause. Indeed, given our present moral state, I commend anyone who has second thoughts about abandoning that practice, which is endorsed by modern America's unhinged state religion. But I'm not sure those second thoughts indicate that the person subject to them is either liberal or conservative in any true historical sense. That individual inhabits a world so vastly different from the one in which liberalism or conservatism flourished that the most we can say about his change of heart is that he's become slightly less radically leftist than his erstwhile friends. I mean, this is true. What he says there, these people aren't conservative. We've moved so far away from whatever that term means anymore. I mean, I do agree with Paul there. We don't really have an understanding for what this means in this age. We say people are conservative that simply just reject some of the more idiotic positions of the left. This is why you have to go back to R.L. Dabney in 1871. He said, look, the Northern conservative is simply the person that's going to accept all the disregarded and trashed ideas of the left as they move forward in their ongoing progressive onslaught on America. In other words, and this is where Dabney gets in a lot of, or people that read Dabney and they start talking about Dabney and they don't like it because he says, look, abolitionism was the beginning of it all. That destroyed an order in society. And that led to feminism and other things. The article where he makes that case is called Women's Rights Women. And it's a really fascinating piece because he claims, of course, that all these isms are attached to these reformist movements, which are a distortion of everything that, say, the founding was about or American principles were about. And maybe he's right about that. But, I mean, as we get to the late 19th century, we move away from any type of conservative order and we simply call conservatives someone who's resisting the latest innovation by the left. So as you know, it could be someone who says, well, wait, I'm for these things, but you all are going too far now. That we would call that years ago a neoconservative. That's what we would have called that person. They weren't really a conservative. They were sort of conservative because they're resisting the latest innovation, but they're not really that conservative because they've now accepted these positions, which were completely alien to conservatism. Now, that is a very important argument, I think, when you talk about American conservatism. The use of liberal becomes even less plausible when we are told that New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez embodies the concept because she supports both a socialist economy and Black Lives Matter. Even allowing for the latitude that journalists take with language, I couldn't imagine a greater conceptual gulf than the one that exists between those whom our media characterize as liberal and those who answered that label 200 years ago. Does it make sense to apply the L word to vastly different ideas in different ages by twisting it into utter meaninglessness? My answer is no. So these people aren't really liberals anymore, which he's right. I mean, look, language matters. Cortez is not a liberal. If she's a liberal, it's in contrast to a conservative who wants to maintain a certain element of status quo. I can make a case that Cortez is actually a conservative trying to maintain a status quo. Not really a reformer. She's trying to maintain the status quo of the order and the regime that's been established. And I think this is one thing where these terms in the modern era have to be understood. I think Paul, again, is perfectly correct about this. Where he and I would disagree is, was there ever an American conservatism to begin with? And now, I read a piece not long ago where he's wrestling with this. He's wrestling with this notion. I mean, gosh, Hartz is everywhere. Even Harry Jaffa says, well, I mean, Hartz is basically correct. We had this liberal order. This is what we're defending. I would say that's not there. This is Bradford and others who are saying this. Look, this is not true. They weren't creating some liberal order. They were looking to the established things they had, things as they are. When conservatives in the 1860s were resisting the Republican Party, it is a defense of the Union and Constitution as they are, not some distortion of these things. It seems to me that the liberal bourgeois age was followed by a post-liberal one, which saw the rise of the modern administrative state and various post-Christian egalitarian ideologies. This post-liberal age is not entirely divorced from its liberal predecessor, but relates to it in the same manner as a Christian heresy does to Christian doctrine. A theological deviation is, in ancient Greek, a heresis, a choice, meaning the choice of a particular doctrine from a larger set of beliefs, together with the rejection of other parts of the set. A similar process is at work when post-liberals try to redefine liberalism by choosing and exaggerating one or more of its features out of the context of the historical whole. So again, he's trying to pull this historical anchor to these terms, and that matters. It does matter. These people didn't exist in vacuums. They were wrestling with things that were going on within their own world, within their own order, changes taking place in their own societies. He says, for example, some, but not all liberals believe, like John Locke, that individuals are endowed with a natural right to life and liberty. Today's progressives and cultural leftists calling themselves liberals have expanded Locke's list of inborn individual rights to include a right to income redistribution favoring clients of the state, a right to ensure gender equality, a right to have the acceptance of gay marriage inflicted on the unwilling, and a right to bestow special rights on members of racial minorities. Yeah, so I mean, look, this is what Dabney was talking about. It's the ever-moving grind of the progressive order. Once you accept the tenets of this change or this term equality, and this is what Gottfried is getting to without saying it, once you accept that, you get this. Now, I think he would also say, well, wait a second, that didn't mean, as he says, that these things were ingrained in that. But it's the natural outcome of it. And he's saying the liberals have destroyed it. So in some ways, he's kind of arguing here that we've distorted Lincoln. We've distorted all of that. The left is distorting it. But the problem is, as he's pointed out several times, he himself, well, who gets to decide what it means? These people are making decisions. This is what the word means now. And this is why he's saying it's just chaotic. We can't really have these terms anymore. What is a post-liberal world? What does this word even mean? One may still discern bits of the older natural rights position in that expanded list. Nevertheless, under the progressive dispensation, rights are pushed in such a radical or opportunistic direction that they would be unrecognizable to long-dead authentic liberals. Other examples come to mind. Liberals typically favored a popular elected legislature, but that didn't mean they believed every resident of their society should be granted the franchise. True. But this was happening. It was expanded out to people that didn't own property, you know, white males of a certain age, and then, of course, you expanded it beyond that. And now we have this fundamental religious belief that everybody should be able to vote. I mean, I think it's going to come to a point when anybody can vote. I mean, who cares who you are? Because if you say, well, children can't vote, well, then you're denying them their basic human rights because you're saying they're under the care of their parents. Well, that would mean that they have no individual rights at that point. They should be able to determine what happens, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's already a push for some lefties to lower the voting age to 16. Why not 14? Why 12? Why these arbitrary numbers? Why make it arbitrary? Whenever somebody thinks they can. Why not? Bourgeois liberals usually insisted that voting applicants establish long-time residence in that country, that those eligible to vote pay taxes at a certain rate, that they hold property, and that they be literate. Now, bourgeois liberals, is that liberal, though, or is that something else? And again, you go back to citizenship requirements and other things, which have been around forever. You go back to the Athenians. The Athenians didn't allow anybody to vote unless you were, very specific requirements for doing this. That's not a liberal position. It's a traditional position. So he's saying liberals didn't mind these things. And Paul's not saying that. This is not a tenet of liberalism, but they allowed for these kind of things. But now liberals have gone beyond that. They've taken these things to an ideological extreme, whereas classical liberals were fine with some traditional anchor on society. That's all he's saying. Classical liberals believed in an anchor. They believed there had to be some traditional anchor, some order out there that maintained the status quo. In some ways, because these things were tried and tested, and they worked. But what the reformers said is, well, why do we have those anyways? That's arbitrary. We just get rid of that. Many self-professed professed liberals as well as conservatives opposed extending the vote to women, which they thought would have a ruinous effect on the family. Voting was seen as a privilege, hardly a human right, and it was understood that extending it too far could deliver society into the hands of those who were unfit to rule and who might be a threat to life and property. It is clearly not the case that the loose way voting is now treated finds any precedent in the liberalism of an earlier age. Even John Stuart Mill, an early welfare state Democrat and feminist, wished to keep the illiterate and those who lived on the public dole from voting. True. There were limits, as he's saying. The point of this piece is there were limits to even the liberal order. But we've abandoned all limits. We're in a post-liberal nightmare. The limitations of the liberal order, which were restrained by a certain semblance of history and place and tradition, are now gone, and liberalism is now run amok. It's become an ideological disposition which has no anchor. There's nothing there. But again, is this not the same argument that the Jaffaites make? Well, Lincoln was correct in this position of equality. Equality as conservative, and the way he understood it, all of that was fine. We've just let all these people run amok, so we just get back to Lincoln, we're okay. We just get back to the middle of the 19th century and these things, we're okay. But Dabney would say, we can't even do that, we got to go back before that, because with that point, you bring in some of these radical reform movements, and that's going to destroy everything anyways. There is no conservative order beyond that. And for an American, once you abandon federalism, you abandon all the anchor. You abandon every aspect of the anchor because at that point, you don't have a way for the political societies, the dominant political cultures to determine the way things work in their own states. And those things can change over time. I mean, we can have people decide things, but the political society in those areas get to determine those things. Although liberals in the 19th century welcomed what was a minimal administrative state by modern standards, a striking difference between then and now should be apparent. In the 19th century, liberals applauded the public servant class, which, as Hegel famously described it in the 1820s, stands above all particular interests, and served the common good. This reflected a widespread liberal approval of public administration, as long as it limited to a few well-defined functions, such as delivering mail, looking after state property and public works, maintaining archives, and in some places providing relief for the poor. Never was it imagined, except by some dreamers on the far left, that the second half of the next century, state administrators would be put in charge of family policy and reconstructing social relations. That was not a small and inevitable step forward in the progress of the liberal idea, as it argued by those on the so-called post-liberal right, but a terrifying quantum leap into unknown territory. So again, they didn't mind certain limited aspects, but this is where the conservatives would say a Dabney piece is important here. He's pointing it out. This is the natural change that's going to take place. One critical reaction against such developments has been to advocate for classical liberalism. However, this represents not a return to the liberalism of the 19th century, but the creation of a libertarian movement stressing individual autonomy. Libertarians have taken over traditions that have a genuine liberal province, such as Austrian economics, constitutional originalism, and the defense of property rights. But some libertarians have added to this mixture a focus on the individual resisting state power in pursuit of his own interests and pleasures. Moreover, in its extreme version, libertarianism has become associated with bohemian lifestyles, flouting bourgeois conventions and reducing life to a series of economic choices. This is not true liberalism. Indeed, much of what is now interpreted as conservatism dating back to the 1930s combined the rejection of the administrative state, which was metastasizing, under the New Deal, with the libertarian penchant for eccentric, individualist lifestyles. So, again, if you understand American conservatism, the post-World War II era, he's basically mentioning the fusionism that came out of around 1960 or so. This is where we said, okay, so we're going to take these parts of libertarianism and these parts of what might be a conservative order, we're going to put them together, and this is going to give us American conservatism. But was it really? Because, again, was it a little too eclectic in what it was doing? Or should we be looking for an older order than that in America? That's a big question. I've said this before. I never forget the conversation I had with Clyde Wilson in his office one day in the 90s when we were talking about Russell Kirk. And I said, how can Russell Kirk have John Adams and John Randolph in the same, or John C. Calhoun in the same book about American conservatism? And that was just one example. He said, well, Kirk was too eclectic. In other words, should American conservatives have any other anchor besides the South? Should it have any other anchor besides the South? Now, we can find there are people in the North and other things over time that even early on that shared views of Southerners. But was that always the anchor? Was it always the American South that had the anchor of a kind of conservatism? Should the only heroes of American conservatism be people like John Randolph or John C. Calhoun or John Taylor of Caroline, who himself said, flirted with some of these ideas, these notions of these high, lofty principles that came out of the independence movement, but then they all quickly abandoned because they saw it as being disastrous. I mean, what should we do? And even Jefferson, his reform didn't stop at his mountains, right? I mean, that's where it ended. He didn't go out and try to reform New York or Pennsylvania. I want to get to the end of this because he says, at the present time in every major one-time Western country, there is an escalating confrontation between two warring groups, a self-conscious ruling class with globalist pretensions, and those normies whom the powerful are demeaning. While the former controls most vital political and educational institutions and most of the culture, industry, and media, the latter embraces most of the white working class and the population outside of the metropolitan areas. Divisions similar to what we see in the United States are characteristic of other Western countries. Everywhere in the West, political elites are flooding their culturally divided countries with third world immigrants to increase the size of the administrative state's dependent class. Needless to say, the same elites are eager to pay off the manipulable newcomers against the deplorables, fascists, or whatever else they call those rooted patriotic families on whom they've made war. So again, it's the use of language. We have an administrative class, we have the establishment class going to war against the people who just want to keep the status quo. Now, what does that status quo actually mean, or what are these things? I mean, who knows? It depends on where you are. Both these groups are locked in a struggle that is likely to go on for some time, and both belong to a post-liberal world, which has less and less to do with a liberal one. Right now, the elites hold almost all the good cards, and their targets are on the defensive. This can change in some limited ways. In the United States, unlike a more subjugated country such as Canada and Germany, there are just too many on the populist right for the left to crush entirely. What's more, the resistance occupies large chunks of the continent. State governments in some regions are now acting to stem the flood of illegals that the ruling left has worked to bring into the country. What is he saying there? The American conservative order relied on federalism. Yes. There is a structural part of this which makes an American conservative different. Germany doesn't have that as much. France doesn't have it. England has it, or Great Britain has it to a degree. But even there, it's much more limited than it is here. Such resistance would be impossible, for example, in a country like Germany, where the population has been bullied into accepting the third world resettlement of their land. As I write this essay, the local government of Augsburg, Germany, is encouraging mass demonstrations, which are likely to turn violent, against Germans who want tighter control of their borders. The officials doing this include the faux conservatives in the Christian Social Party. Opponents of the woke regime in Germany have long been under investigation by government agencies as right-wing terrorists. Although such vindictive measures have been attempted by the ruling left in this country, it has not had nearly the same level of success that such measures have attained elsewhere. High-handed action against dissenters has evoked a far more widespread backlash here than in other parts of what American neoconservatives still describe anachronistically as the free world. It seems highly unlikely that if the populist resistance gains at least regional power in the United States, it would seek to return to the political culture of the 19th century or even embrace the milder forms of post-liberalism that once prevailed here. That ship has already sailed, he said, as the cliche goes. The non-left and the non-elites are now in survival mode, as the left is swelling in numbers by opening borders to millions and millions of illegals. Opponents of this leftist takeover may survive, but are unlikely to ever to rule the entire country. The most they can hope for would be regional autonomy within a larger society that remained under globalist, woke, leftist control. Now, what is he saying here? Well, he's saying we need federalism. We need regionalism. I mean, this is one of the arguments that, of course, the agrarians made in the 1930s. Forget about states. They're useless. We need to have regional governments. A regional order. There can be a southern region. There can be a northern region. There can be a western region. Maybe we even align with each other for defense of this particular part of North America against incursions. We do that. But otherwise, there's nothing there. These regional governments have complete control over the social relations in these areas, the social order, the dominant political culture. But the leftist would never let this happen because of the commitment to ideology. If there's one person out there that would resist, they have to capture those people and make sure that they have all the rights and everything else they need according to their version of what the order should be. This is even the neoconservatives. If there's one person in these states that doesn't want to be part of this seceded order, we can send in the tanks. That's Bill Bennett. There's problems with all this. In areas under their sway, these normies will preserve those values and beliefs that held them together in times of tribulation. These would consist of settled communal arrangements and a shared religious faith, but not necessarily what our strict constructionists understand as constitutional rights. Since these beleaguered outposts would have to protect themselves against infiltration, it is hard to imagine they would care about constitutional niceties or the finer points of a temporarily distant bourgeois classical liberal society. They would also be made up largely of those with little advanced education except in vocational fields. Most of those who have been influenced by academic culture now belong to the woke left. He says, what I'm offering is the best case outcome. If the present woke elites totally marginalize their opposition, a process that is already occurring elsewhere in first world countries, we may soon be living in an anti-liberal hell. The victors would sooner jail the other side than allow it to gain influence, and if circumstances require this course, the ruling left will unleash more violent riots and then, with media assistance, blame the disturbances on the right, as they did after the death of George Floyd. I agree with him. So how do you do this? You have to have a commitment. The states have to stand up and do these things, because in the American order, there is still the legal structure in place, at least now. And that would be the states that have powers and abilities to stop this stuff. He says, for all these reasons, I am forced to conclude that liberalism, as it once flourished in the bourgeois West, may be a thing of the past. I say this without pleasure, but with an understanding that those conditions and social underpinnings that permitted a liberal worldview and liberal sensibilities to flourish no longer exist. By now, the remnants of that liberalism are vanishing in what may be the end phase of our late post-liberal age. So what are we left with? Something that's not even liberal. It's authoritarian. We're going to get authoritarianism. Maybe. Again, the American conservative order can still rely on some of the structure in place, the state. So if we go to regional areas, we have these remnants, so to speak. But if we have regional areas that the states actually stand up, and there are people in these states that are starting to believe in some of these powers, maybe they can stop some of the stuff. I don't know. I mean, Gottfried brings that up. The American order is different than Europe. Maybe Europe's gone. But maybe America can survive because of the structure that was in place that was designed to preserve the local customs, traditions, precedents against an overarching central authority, or overpowerful central authority. That was the whole point. Anyways, great article, though. Something to really chew on and think about as we look at what the world might become in the next 50 to 100 years, and where we stand in America in different, in a view of our relations with our fellow Americans and people in our own states or people throughout the United States. All right. See you next time on the Brian McClanahan Show. See you then.